This is a podcast from The Times. Go to thetimes.co.uk.
The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world.
Hello, Buglers, and welcome to issue 168 of The Bugle, audio newspaper for a visual world for the week beginning Monday, the 17th of October, 2011, with me, Andy Zaltzman, in London, recovering from missing out on the Nobel Prizes again this year. Always seems to go to the professional scientists. Doesn't seem fair. And joining me for the first time ever as a married man.
Yes.
Fresh from his honeymoon after a tremendously successful first marriage. Let's be realistic, he's in showbiz. It's the new Mrs. John Oliver.
Hello, Andy. Hello, Buglers. And welcome back to the Bugle, Buglers. And welcome back to the Bugler's Bugle after an interrupted summer of scattered bugles. Get ready for a full downpour of bullshit over the next few months. There is a tropical storm of regular bugles on the horizon, and they're going to blow your f***ing face off. We've been off, as Andy mentioned, for a multitude of reasons. Andy had to go to Edinburgh, I had to attend the Emmys, and then a couple of weeks ago, Andy and I had to do something important together, and that was attend my f***ing wedding. This is now a fully married bugle. Now, whether it remains that way will depend on the patience and human resilience of the wives involved. And I don't think anyone could blame them if either of them reached for the ripcord at some point. I must say that in what was an incredibly fun weekend, Andy, you might not remember all of it, by the way. You were absolutely wasted for part of it. But yep. Perhaps the most fun thing was an afternoon of Britain against the US in both forms of football. It was English football first. A single, but not for long, John Oliver scampered onto a through pass, easily out-sprinting the 11-year-old boy who was marking him, to coolly round the goalkeeper and slide the ball into the empty net. And by net, I mean the space between two garden chairs. Perhaps the goal of the game, though, went to a not currently drunk, but about to be obliterated by cocktails, Andy Zaltzman, who scored, ripped his T-shirt off, slid across the wet ground on his stomach, jumped up and swung his T-shirt round his head like he was a castaway trying to attract the attention of a rescue helicopter. It was a celebration that said, goal. I just scored a goal. And following that, which was a justified win for the UK, it was the UK against the US at American football. A sport that most of the UK team were hamstrung in, not only due to not having played it before, but also due to a majority of the team having no idea what the rules were.
Now, no one knows what the rules are of American football.
No one knows. It's an improvised sport. Yep. The US won, but I think the most important statistic came from Rob Riggle's period at quarterback, which I believe featured statistics of two passes, two interceptions. He was intercepted by two English people who weren't entirely sure what sport they were playing. And one of those was you, Andy.
Yeah, what an interception as well, John. Sprinted a good, 25, maybe 75 yards to my left at full speed. Leapt in the air, knocked it up with one hand, caught it with two, ran it back 95 yards for a touchdown.
Now, Andy, was there a thought in your head when you caught that ball of thinking, what am I supposed to do now?
Well, No, I've seen enough pretends football, as I think of it, to know that I was supposed to peg it up the other end and score.
Yeah.
But I thought, I don't maybe have quite that explosive burst of pace that I had in my youth anymore.
Yeah.
So, what a catch, John. What a catch. That sat Riggle down. Big son.
How long did it take, Andy, for the alcohol to work its way out of your system?
Well, John,
because you were suffering the next morning.
I was suffering big time the next morning and the following morning. And medium time the morning after that.
Was there a particular drink that did the damage, Andy, or was it the mass of them?
It was more a tactic rather than a specific drink, John. Because I began with a Bloody Mary. There's nothing wrong with that. It's a traditional British drink.
Mm-hmm.
While you were drinking grits, or whatever it is you get up to these days. And then I made the mistake of going to there seemed to be quite a lot of cocktail bars at your wedding, John.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And just said, can you just make me a cocktail with some fruit in it?
Oh, that was specific.
And a couple of them later, and everything went a little bit blurry. But yeah, it was... It was impressive stuff. I think it's a shame that we obviously couldn't invite all buglers to your wedding, which I know you'd have loved to have done. But
I'd have loved that.
The missus clamped down on that. So I thought I'd share with our listeners a few more details of what went on, since you've really only talked about the sport rather than the momentous emotional occasion it was for you, the landmark in your own passage through life. But I guess that's what we'd expect. So, of course, a ceremony after we'd all dusted ourselves off from the football. And I did score a goal and pick off a couple of interceptions, but I did also lose a pair of shoes as a result. But anyway, the ceremony eventually began when John, on his white stallion...
Yes.
You must have been taking some serious horse-riding lessons, John. I've never seen one do a backflip before. Anyway, in rode John, flanked by his new Hollywood buddies Richard Gere and Denzel Washington, wearing a full replica of the robes that Henry VIII wore on one of his wedding days, to joyous shouts from the American part of the crowd of, "You're a man, J.O.! You're a man!" And from the British contingent of, "I think that's a little bit excessive." John then dismounted in the arms of his love guru co-star and fortnightly cribbage companion Justin Timberlake. There followed an anxious wait for the bride, the real bride at least, as five dummy brides paraded up the aisle to trick the massed ranks of paparazzi, who had gathered outside the half-scale replica White House in front of which the service was being conducted. Finally, soon-to-be real Mrs. Oliver arrived, resplendent in her Giorgio Armani motorcycling leathers. She's always been a massive Valentino Rossi fan. With the traditional set of American elk antlers perched delicately atop her live koi carp fascinator.
Certainly, as is tradition.
Yeah, took some regular spraying to keep that alive through the service. The service was conducted by Hey Hey Abraham Lincoln, America's leading Abraham Lincoln impersonator.
Lucky to get him.
And was presented in association with John and Mrs. John's proud commercial sponsors, Halliburton and the American Society of Grits Manufacturers.
Someone's got to pay for it.
The vows were exchanged, taken word for word from the marriage of Daphne and Des in the Australian soap opera Neighbours.
As is tradition.
And then John sang his special wedding day song, "I'd Still Love You If You Turned Into Karl Rove." Dinner followed, a hunt-your-own buffet of warthog carpaccio. Then the speeches, one word by each member of the congregation, which didn't make a great deal of sense, but you could really feel the emotion. And then John and Mrs. John climbed into Air Force One. Lovely gesture from the big man, John, especially as he couldn't actually make it himself, and flew off to honeymoon in the African Republic of Niger. It's what she wanted, somewhere hot and sandy where there wouldn't be too many other tourists. So there you go, I hope that's given you a little picture.
Yep.
Bugles.
Beat that, Kim Kardashian. Beat that.
To be honest, were I to have tried to recount exactly what did happen, it would be similarly vague. But, I mean, the key fact was that in your room the night before you got married, you did have a helicopter.
Yeah, that is probably worth pointing out. We did it in this amazing place where... The room I was in, it was they got a US rescue helicopter, and then they built a room around that helicopter.
And to the disappointment of someone who's being needed to be rescued at the time.
There were definitely some US rescue helicopter pilots running desperately into a helicopter hangar somewhere and going, "Holy shit, where's the helicopter gone?" And in fact, I was sleeping in it the night before my wedding. It was good to have the most adult day of your life preceded by one of the most childish evenings.
So this is Bugle 168, coincidentally 168. Also, the note made at the start of a class I went to last week for people who are either afraid of Germany or absolutely despise hot infused drinks. Seven people turned up, but it wasn't the most balanced class. 168.
Oh.
It's good to be back. Oh, God, it's good to be back.
Oh boy.
I think those cocktails might still be working through the system, John. And it's for the week beginning Monday, the 17th of October, 2011, meaning that 4 years ago this week, John, a little star shone above London and New York, and people saw the star and they thought, there must be a sign of the birth of something truly incredible that's going to change the world. What could it be? So they followed that star, and they kept on following that star.
Yes.
And then they ended up 400 million light years away in space, burning to death. But by coincidence, that very same week, the Bugle was born.
Yes.
4 years old this week. And the world is a lot poorer, quite a bit stroppier, and 4 years closer to the merciful annihilation of Armageddon, for which we can only humbly apologise.
With a big 04. Happy birthday, Andy.
Happy birthday, John. It's all happening for you this month.
Top story this week. All we are saying is this is bullshit. Andy, 2011 really does seem to have been a year of protest so far, with the Arab Spring causing protests to emerge across the Middle East, austerity measures producing riots in Greece and the UK, and now a group of demonstrators called Occupy Wall Street, doing very nearly what their literal named organisation implies, except rather than occupying Wall Street itself, which would be problematic as it's notoriously hard to pitch a tent in the middle of a heavily trafficked street. They've instead occupied a nearby park and have been camped out there for the last 4 weeks. And I suppose this has turned out to be a good timing for protests, Andy, not only because of the global economic situation, but also because 2011 is a bit of a down year for sport. Now, you had the World Cup last year, you haven't got the Olympics until next year, so it's a very convenient time for people to be pushed to breaking point.
Well, are you saying that America is not captivated by the Rugby World Cup, John?
I'm implying it. I'm not saying it because I know it would be too hurtful. The media were largely ignoring the protests for the first few days, and the protesters were struggling to get any national attention at all until a video emerged online of an NYPD cop pepper spraying a group of young female protesters for no apparent reason other than the desire to pepper spray women. And all of a sudden, Occupy Wall Street became catnip to cameras as the media descended on them like a swarm of confused wasps. And it's pretty depressing that the only way to get attention for a vastly important topic is something like that. Well, I'd love to turn this camera on and listen to you, but I'm going to need you to break a window or at least get tear gassed, or I just don't think my camera will work.
Got to have an angle, John.
Yeah.
Got to have an angle. But it's been sparked by the massive financial inequality and the reckless risk-taking that's led to the economic catastrophe that's unfolding over the last few years. And here's a fact, John. They talk a lot about the 1% of Americans, and the richest 1% of Americans could afford to have the poorest 75% of Americans killed with one phone call. That kind of shows the unequal country that you're living in.
That's a chilling statistic.
Yeah. Herman Cain, the prospective Republican presidential candidate, said some amazing things. There's been some quite interesting responses to this whole problem, ranging from "Yeah, they've got a point" to "Who won the f***ing Cold War?" Herman Cain told protesters, "Don't blame Wall Street. Don't blame the big banks. If you don't have a job and you're not rich, blame yourself."
There is that compassionate conservatism that the Republican Party have become famous for.
Herman Cain, of course, famously devoted Christian. And I believe he was quoting directly from his religious pin-up boy, literally, Jesus Christ. And he said, if you don't have a job and you're not rich, blame yourself. It's from the Gospel according to St. Jeff, originally discovered in an archaeological dig in the Middle East. And it reads as follows. "Indeed, Jesus did pass a beggar in the street, and he saw that the beggar was hungry and cold. And Jesus wound down the windows on his new unbelievably flash donkey. And Jesus shouted, 'Hey, loser! Things not turned out too good for you, Mickey No Shoes, eh? What happened? Personal tragedy? Lack of opportunity? Or simply did you choose to live a more spiritual, less materialistic lifestyle? Well, what I say to you is, I make 50k a pop on the after-dinner circuit, doing my stories and magic tricks. Let me be your inspiration. Now pick up your bed and get the freak out of my way. I've got chicks to meet. Let's roll, fellas. Matty, Luco, you guys write that one up. Mark's a chon boy. Make up some shit about me turning a badger into a blancmange for a kid's party. Giddy up.
Jeff, put that pen down." So what is it? What is Occupy Wall Street? Well, as is often the case with these anti-corporate protests, they're a mixed bag. You see that at the G20 protest as well. It's a spicy protest paella of anti-war, anti-globalisation, anti-capitalism and anti-any number of things. And it's all dressed up in a sartorial soup of black anarchist T-shirts and the kind of clothes that scream, "I am a massive hippie." There has been criticism of there being no cohesive message coming out of the movement so far, although a common theme seems to be, hey, remember what those banks did a few years ago? F*** them, right? I mean, seriously, f*** them. That was a catastrophe. And that's something that I think the vast majority of not just Americans, but human beings could get behind. In fact, I think the vast majority of people here in America fundamentally agree with Occupy Wall Street's concerns over the financial system and over the increasing wealth gap. But I think the vast majority of Americans also have serious reservations over drum circles. So the mainstream reaction to the protests is a little complicated.
But it's been presented as a kind of classic false choice, in which the Republicans seem to be responding by saying, so, you disapprove of the rampant excesses of unsustainable gambling that has jackhammered the world to the precipice of economic annihilation? Yes, we do. Ah, so you don't want any financial sector at all? You f***ing commie. All right, Stalin, you want me to set up a gulag and murder your village for you, then? It's completely... pretty much saying, all right, OK, so you disapprove of Wall Street. So what has brought about all the medical advances that have enabled people to live longer and longer? Money. And you want there to be no money in the world? Right. Within 10 years, we will all be dead. That's basically... Herman Cain said another thing. He said, the proof is quite simply that the bankers and the people on Wall Street did not write these failed policies of the Obama administration. And one of these policies, presumably, on his argument, is absolutely shoved the global economy, prompting a Wall Street meltdown in 2008 before coming into office to clear up the after shit in 2009. If that was their policy, John, and they managed to pull it off, fair play to the little Kenyan Ayatollah. Fair play to him.
The conservative media have also stooped so low as to criticise the protesters for being smelly. Well, that may or may not be true. I would simply say this. You try camping out in New York for a month in a park with no bathrooms, having to wash in a nearby bagel shop's toilets, and take a sniff at yourself afterwards. After that, let he who does not honk like a Canadian goose cast the first insult.
You never hear that criticism of, you know, the American troops in the war. You know, I've seen the series Pacific, John.
Yeah.
I mean, those places must have stank. But we never hear about that. It's always they were heroes. They're laying down their lives for their country. That's what it comes down to. Professional mayor Mickey Bloomberg said, if the jobs they're trying to get rid of in the city, the people that work in finance, which is a big part of our economy, if they go away, we're not going to have any money to pay our municipal employees or clean the parks or anything else. Which I guess in a way is true, but he could also have phrased it, if the people who work in finance, who clubbed together to jackhammer the world to the precipice of economic annihilation, had not clubbed together to jackhammer the world to the precipice of economic annihilation, we might have more money to pay our municipal employees, clean the parks and anything else. And I mean anything. We're talking jetpacks for all. We're talking bouncy castles outside every subway station. We're talking buying Mexico and Canada and breeding a horse with Wi-Fi so you can check your emails while you're doing dressage.
Obviously, with a movement so broad, there are going to be some incredibly camera-friendly and incredibly annoying factions within it that you just have to try and grit your teeth and tolerate. Some are employing these silent applause sparkle hands, these protesters, instead of clapping speeches. They raise their hands like jazz hands and shake them back and forth, the applause that the deaf community use. And their argument is actual applause drowns out people's ability to be heard, which might make sense logically, but to actually see them do that during a speech makes me want to turn a fire hose on them. Also, there were moments like when a man in a Smash Capitalism t-shirt suggested a minute silence for Steve Jobs. And, you know, that was a lovely gesture. I loved that man too and his products as well, but of the many qualities he had, one of them was that he was an amazing capitalist and your t-shirt undercuts your gesture slightly there. There was also a moment at a rally when Congressman John Lewis, the historic civil rights leader, attempted to address the crowd, only for some moron to propose a motion that he shouldn't speak, as no one person was more important than anyone else in the movement. And to the frustration of the majority of the crowd, Congressman Lewis was then unable to speak. And whilst no one would claim that John Lewis was more important as flesh and blood than that protester, he is a shit of a lot more important as a human being. And when in his presence, you might want to shut the f*** up and listen to him.
Bloomberg also said this. He said the protesters are trying to take away the tax base we have because none of this is good for tourism.
No.
Really, Mickey B? Really? It's this whole thing an anti-tourism wangdangle. Is that it? Is that going to be the clinching factor in whether people decide whether or not to go to New York?
Is New York's attractiveness as a tourist destination so weak that a group of young people standing up for international rights across the world will go, well, God, I'm not going there. I can't go there. They'll ruin it.
Do you fancy a trip to New York, love? I don't know, pet. I've never heard of it. Where is it? Oh, it's in America. Oh, it's the most iconic city in the world, the city that never sleeps. Well, it must be a bit cranky then. Shouldn't have had kids. You can be a real prick sometimes, Jeff. It's our anniversary. Come on, it's got some of the world's great museums, some of the great modern architecture, phenomenal food, vibrant melting pot of American and global culture. Are there any good DIY shops? I need a new saw. You can probably get a new saw, though, and the exchange rate's decent, so it'll probably be quite cheap. Oh, that's good. Could I get some brackets for the new shelf in the upstairs toilet? Almost certainly. It's got everything a city could have. All right, love, you've won me over. Hang on, is there a tiny, tiny party that is currently the scene of a slightly scruffy protest? Yes. F*** that, let's go to Torre Molinos.
But for all this, for all the confusion over a single message, for all the frustration over groups of cartoon hippies, the movement is clearly capturing a mood of widespread dissatisfaction over the financial system. And this is also what ideological young people are supposed to do. They're not supposed to overthink it. They're supposed to just do stuff. Because other people are either too busy, too tired, or too lazy. Young people are supposed to do this shit. Some of the greatest things that have ever happened have been started by young people that look like morons. They don't necessarily need a message. They just need to state ludicrously ideological statements like destroy capitalism and arrest all bankers, and then the majority of adults will take over that message and translate their frustration into something non-crazy, such as demanding raising the top tax rate, regulating the finance industry, and prosecuting the rampant criminal behaviour of banks. But let's hope the protesters are okay today, as Mayor Bloomberg announced yesterday that the city was going to clean the square today. They're going to clean it. And they were ordering the protesters out so they could clean up, and then said that they will be allowed back in. And whilst the first part of that looks like it's definitely going to happen, it remains to be seen whether or not the second part will actually come about. In terms of international reaction, Poland's former president, Lech Walesa, says he supports the Occupy Wall Street movement in New York, and then went on to say that he's planning either a visit or writing a letter to the protesters. To which the protesters said, Lech Walesa, a letter will be fine.
Newt Gingrich, another Republican presidential candidate in the making.
Oh my God.
He said, "We
have got a bad field."
We,
oh my God! I mean, really bad.
Even without Palin, that's a disaster. Newt Gingrich said, "We have had a strain of hostility to free enterprise." And frankly, a strain of hostility to classic America, starting in our academic institutions and spreading across this country.
Mm-hmm.
The Reds are under the bed, Newt. But is this not more a strain of hostility? I mean, forgive me if I've misread this protest, but is it not more a strain of hostility towards fucking idiotic enterprise rather
yes.
than free enterprise?
That's exactly.
What is classic America? Well, the founding fathers sat around their magic constitution writing table saying, come on, let's get this fucking thing scribbled out fast. There is some serious money to be made on the markets out there. Shadow Chancellor Ed Balls admitted that regulation on banks had not been tough enough. Well spotted, Mr. Balls. It turned out that your tactic when in government of asking them nicely and complimenting them on their new hairdo wasn't quite enough to keep them in line. As voters, we know that, economically, we are going to get whacked in the plums, and it merely comes down to choosing who we want to do the whacking, how hard, and with how spiky a cudgel. But it seems to me, John, that our politicians are increasingly powerless. I saw this, we've had the party conference season over here, and it's just an economic gloom from soup to nuts, basically. And it seems in the face of the economy, our politicians are like snooker players. They dress up smartly, they put on a serious face, they walk methodically around the table looking as if they're making in-depth educated calculations of how best to do things. They meticulously chalk their cue. They line up their shot. They expect quiet reverence from everyone watching. They settle down. They tap their middle finger on the table. They take a deep breath. They pull back the cue. They pause. They glance nervously at the audience. They shut their eyes as tightly as possible. And they whack the ball as hard as possible. They then open their eyes, look at the mess that is ensued, and blame the cue, physics, and their opponents. They promise to do better next time while snapping the cue in half and skewering themselves in the eye with a kebab stick, whilst the referee calls foul stroke and bridal capitalism 4 and a miss. Would you like the balls replaced where they were? OK, this could be tricky. Give me a couple of minutes. And in Greece, the protests have continued as the country melts down like a dead zebra's ice cream. And it's the star of the Greek protest movement has become a dog. Mm-hmm. A stray dog called Sausage, or Loukanikos in Greek. He's been joining in the protests. kind of running along and barking in the face of tear gas and aggressive policing. He seems to love it. He can't get enough of it. Advocating, as dogs tend to, a global economy based more on rewards for good behaviour than for risk-taking. Edible rewards and tickles on the tummy. Typical dog. Hasn't thought of the broader economic consequences. Doesn't know what the f*** he's barking about. He was also very critical of the IMF. Was sausage. He said, woof. And dogs, of course, have occupied a special place in Greek culture ever since Leonidas, the king of Sparta, led the 300 to a heroic but valuable defeat against Persia at the Battle of Thermopylae whilst fighting the entire battle with his pet chihuahua Minky Tutu under his arm, wearing a little jacket to keep her warm. Now, you, John, as we've discussed on the Beagle before, you recently acquired not only a wife, but more importantly, mm-hmm. a dog.
Yep.
Any hints of left-leaning impulses in little Hoagie?
Well, it's not clear yet. I guess the test would be if I take her down to Occupy Wall Street, let her off the leash, and see who she runs to.
Yeah, because I guess the thing is she's a purebred Labrador, isn't she? And is it a retriever?
No, she's a golden retriever.
Golden retriever.
I don't know how purebred she is either, but you're nearly right.
Yeah, but you know, basically blonde.
With a bit of gold on her ears,
but basically...
And little, she's
blonde
little.
And ethnically pure, John. You have basically got Hitler's super dog.
Yeah, that's what I was looking for. That's what I asked for, and that's what they provided me with.
But that shows how bad things are in Greece when even the stray dogs are protesting at the cutbacks.
Well, she's only 4 months old Hoagie. Yeah. And, you know, I'm certainly raising her to be a liberal dog, and this should be the years in which she's liberal.
Yeah, I guess.
It's only as an older dog that she might swing hard right. Yeah.
Well, my tragically now dead dog, Tash, 1984 to 1997, she used to be pretty strongly anti-Thatcher in the late 80s. She used to go into the woods and she'd say, "Andy, here's my Maggie impression," and shit on the public footpath. Bit direct, but satirically valid.
Plot news now, and the US revealed this week that they had foiled an Iranian plot to assassinate Saudi Arabia's ambassador to the United States by setting off a bomb in a Washington restaurant. President Obama said it involved members of the Iranian government and the Quds Force, an elite unit of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. Now, that sounds bad if it's true, and President Obama seemed 100% confident that it was, but it might actually be good news, because if it is indeed true, it shows that the Iranians are not so much threatening as they are fucking idiots. And that should be reassuring for anyone who's thinking of being frightened of Iran in the near future. If the Russian Secret Service want you dead, Andy, you just die. You don't nearly die, you actually and immediately die. And what the Iranians did sounded like the plot of a bad movie.
Get your agent onto it.
One of the accused approached a US informant who was posing as a member of a Mexican drug cartel to carry out the assassination. He then wired $100,000 to a US bank account as a down payment for the assassination, which would eventually cost $1.5 million. It's good to know that that's the going rate as well, Andy.
That's a lot, isn't it?
It's a lot. But, you know, just in case you ever need to bump someone off using a Mexican drug cartel, it's good to know how much you'd need to save up.
You must be able to get it cheap. Do they do, like, 2-for-1 deals or anything?
I would have thought so. It certainly doesn't seem like a recession price. Anyway, the point is, that doesn't sound inherently ridiculous until you hear about the Iranian involved. Mansour Arbabassia, 56 years old, was an Iranian-American used car salesman who lived in Texas, nicknamed Scarface, with a string of failed businesses behind him. A friend and former roommate, who was asked about him, apparently questioned his ability to carry out the plot and said his socks would not match. He was always losing his keys and his cell phone. I mean, he's not exactly James Bond, Andy, is he? I don't recall James Bond ever losing his keys, saying, "Oh, Miss Moneypenny, did you see what I do with my car keys? I had them with me when I walked in. Please help me retrace my steps. I can't hotwire the Aston Martin again, Miss Moneypenny. Last time I tried to do that, I shut the ejector sheet off. Which is complete bullshit."
Hey, Sean, thanks for dropping in. What have you done with John?
He's gone. He's gone. He said we only had him for about 35 seconds, Andy. Thanks, Sean!
Also, why are they using Mexican goons, John? What is wrong with Cuban goons? They have a proven record in high-profile assassinations in America. Proven record.
The details get even better because the code words used sound like they're straight out of a Naked Gun film. The Mexican informant taped all their telephone calls, and the assassination is referred to as painting the house. And the Iranian made sure to remind the intermediary assassin that the house couldn't be left half painted. I love that, Andy, because that's barely even code. Do not half paint the fucking house. Do the whole job. Don't half-ass it and expect to be paid. I want the house painted and painted red. Get it? Dark red. Like blood red. Get it? The whole house. Get it? I don't want to come back and find a part-painted house that's still breathing. Do you get it? And once you've painted the house, make sure you bury it somewhere that no one can find it. Do you get what I'm saying?
Stupid government ministers news now, and the British Defence Secretary Liam Fox is under increasing pressure for his job. In fact, I think there's probably a good chance that by the time you download this podcast, he will be the former Defence Secretary. It's turned out that the man who was best man at his wedding, a man called Adam Werrity, accompanied him on 18 times on overseas trips and numerous times at meetings in Britain, and also printed business cards off claiming he was an official advisor to Liam Fox, the Defence Secretary, with official House of Commons insignia on it. It's turned out this man was paid by private firms. Was it to lobby Liam Fox? I guess that's a question that needs to be answered. Mm-hmm. And the whole thing, John, it absolutely stinks. Fox has denied wrongdoing, but has admitted errors of judgment. Now, errors of judgment are not ideal in the job of Defence Secretary, when you have to deal with despots, war criminals, and the mechanisms of slaughter. You want someone whose judgment does not lead to him taking a personal friend on 18 overseas trips. One, maybe. 18 is too many, Mr. Fox. 18!
But, Andy, you have to admit, it takes real balls to not resign immediately. I almost find that impressive, to think that you could get away with letting your friends pretend to be a Ministry of Defence advisor. It's a level of self-confidence that I'm afraid I simply do not have. But, in his defence, Andy, isn't that what friends do?
Well, exactly.
If I ever held major government office, I would definitely want you to tag along and pretend to be a national security expert. Why? Because it would be funny, Andy. After everyone had gone, you'd be able to say, you'll never guess what I just advised the Prime Minister of Ecuador to do. I think he's going to invade Bolivia. And then we'd high-five and we'd go and watch the news and wait for the kabooms to start. And if you ever hold office, I'd expect you to allow me to do the same. That's what powerful friends are for.
And we complain about the quality of people going into politics. But if you're not even allowed to use your political position to covertly swing influence for your buddies, no one is going to want to go into it, John.
What's the point?
No one.
It's exactly like when they said, we can't take away bonuses from banks that have behaved criminally. That's what attracts the top talent to the job. It's the same here, Andy. It's the same here.
Fox has claimed that Werrity did come to his office in the House of Commons on multiple occasions, but, and I quote, it was mostly just to play Angry Birds on our iPhones together. And this just breaking now, it turns out that Mr. Fox actually let Mr. Werrity direct an airstrike on Tripoli from his office whilst they wore Rambo costumes and shouted kapow, kapow at his computer. He also allowed Mr. Werrity to dress up as Churchill and parade around Westminster smoking cigars and threatening to bomb Dresden. He also lent him a submarine for a deep-sea fishing holiday and promised Mr. Werrity that he would try and set him up on a date with Hillary Clinton. And David Cameron's judgment has been questioned on a number of occasions this year. Is he sticking by Liam Fox too long? He says he's just waiting for all the facts to come out, which I guess is fair enough. But Cameron's judgment... This is the man who appointed Andy Coulson, the former editor of the News of the World, to misinform the public on his behalf. The whole thing... fucking stinks. New politics, John. It's a new politics. It's no wonder people in Britain aren't that interested in democracy anymore. It's hard to think what could be done to get people back into it. I guess 30 years of dictatorship usually does the trick. Maybe we should give that a spin.
I'll do it.
Yeah. the right man for the job.
And massively up for it.
What, being a dictator?
Yeah.
You'd be good at it, Chris.
Thanks.
God, you would escalate that power and control so quickly. Feature section now, small-time fools. And if some of those stories weren't idiotic enough for you, there were some other magnificent morons at work this week. A spectator this week who threw a hot dog in the direction of Tiger Woods said he was inspired to carry out the strange action by watching the movie Drive. He stated, as soon as the movie ended, I thought to myself, I have to do something courageous and epic. I have to throw a hot dog on the green in front of Tiger Woods. See, the beauty is, Andy, everyone has their own definition of the word epic. Yep. For Rosa Parks, it was refusing to move to the back of the bus. For Neil Armstrong, it was walking on the moon. And for Brandon Kelly, it was throwing a hot dog at Tiger Woods. Who can say which of the three was the greatest achievement, Andy? History will be the judge.
I think it might not take long to deliberate on his verdict.
Also, I'm guessing that the director of Drive is surprised at the particular influence that his movie had. I think he'd be entitled to say, hold on. I directed a movie where Ryan Gosling plays a stunt driver who moonlights as a getaway driver. How the f*** does that imply that someone should throw a hot dog at Tiger Woods? I think I'd better go check my previous movies fast in case any of them tell someone to throw a chicken burrito at Novak Djokovic.
I don't know, maybe the subtitles were wrong.
Yeah, that could be it.
You could be watching a pirated version from Malaysia or something.
Yeah, with hidden messages in. Why is Ryan Gosling telling me to throw a burrito at Tiger Woods? Hot dog at Tiger Woods.
Hot dog. He's not an idiot, John. And why would you throw a burrito at Tiger Woods?
No one would do that.
Your emails now. And, well, there's, you know, a lot of big causes in the world this year, John. We've had people fighting and dying for democracy, for human rights. We've got the protests against the excesses of big business. Mm-hmm. And, of course, in Britain we had the riots in favour of free electrical goods. And now, arguably the greatest cause of them all. This email has come in from Michael, who writes, where is the congressman's penis? Andy, we've been waiting for the next instalment for months. I swear, I will flat out murder you. I will place every bugle to this day into a needle-covered CD and ram it up your freaking ass. So come up with either another story series or finish it. You disgusting, radish-headed excuse for a piece of rectal trash. Enchanté. Prepare for your doom, General Pun Master Dickweed Smasher. There we go. So people really want this back, John.
There were a lot of emails. In the backlog of emails while we've been away, a significant amount of them have been about bringing back the Congressman's penis. And I think the greatest achievement of the Congressman's penis story, Andy, is that this amount of emails will be written concerning this particular subject. You wouldn't have thought you would do something that would inspire people to, like Jennifer Davis, to write an email with a subject line simply, in all caps, bring back the congressman's penis. That wouldn't have made any sense until you wrote that great tale. So, Andy, are you going to do it? Are you going to shut that down?
Next week. I will bring it back. I'm not saying I'll shut it down next week.
God, no. That's not what I asked.
We don't know. I mean, it's a very long and complicated story. And I've been working a lot on the character development and the narrative arcs.
Are you going to relight the fire to put it out once and for all, Andy? Or are you going to just start another forest fire?
Well, I don't know. You know, fire is as fire does, John.
Thank you, Forrest. So what you're saying is you promise there will be a chapter of the Congressman's penis next week, Andy.
There will be a chapter of the Congressman's penis next week.
Might be the final chapter.
It might or might not be the final chapter. It depends where my muse takes me, John. You know?
Will it be the final chapter in the first book?
Well, I mean, did Shakespeare have someone standing over his shoulder saying, come on, mate, three acts is plenty? He didn't, though. He didn't. Just got to let that story breathe.
I'm confused because I thought it was already written and we were just reading excerpts because it was John Grisham.
That's right.
Is that not right?
Well, what I mean is that there's a lot of notes from Grisham that need to be processed, and because obviously, you know, it was a first draft, so it wasn't entirely entirely finished, and so I'm having to work out which were the bits that he would have, you know, would have stuck with, and which are the bits that he was, you know, just writing for the sake of writing. I mean, that whole 20-page bit about the former tennis player Pam Shriver, I mean, what was that? Well, what did that have to do with anything? I mean, it was vivid and expressive and alarmingly pornographic, but what relevance did it have? What relevance did it have to the story? Do keep your emails coming into thebugle@timesonline.co.uk. Sport now, and there is no sport. There is no sport because England are too bad at rugby. They have managed to embarrass themselves on and off the pitch with a display of sporting and behavioural ineptitude for the ages. It's been... They've played rugby as if they're trying to eradicate the concept of hope. Mm-hmm. And they're basically to rugby what Oliver Cromwell was to Christmas. Was a dark, dark moment in our nation's sporting history, John. Very dark indeed. So we'll be back next week.
We will.
With the congressman's penis and a preview of the Rugby World Cup final, which will be next weekend. Happy birthday, Buglers. We'll be back next week.
Happy birthday. Bye.